Good morning, everyone. My name is Doug, and I am alcoholic.
Good morning, Doug.
And I bring you greetings from my home group, which is the Young at Heart group in Los Gatos, California. And before I get started, I just want to thank you all for coming out on a gorgeous Danish Saturday morning. And it was raining yesterday. It's beautiful today. And I don't know about you, but me in my past life, I'm thinking like, no, this is nice weather. I'm going to just like go to the beach. Thank you. So I want to honor you for taking time in your recovery to come spend a Saturday, you know, with our fellowship. And what it shows is how much love and dedication you have for AA. And so I just want to acknowledge that and thank you for coming out this morning, especially to talk on or to listen to me talk on our three legacies. Not a topic that is probably very common at conventions, at least maybe in Denmark it is, and it's just I'm the one that's out of the loop. But I just want to thank you for taking the time to do that. I'm a drunk. And I'm not an expert on anything. I got sober a number of years ago, and I love the big book, and I love our literature, and I love our structure, and I've studied quite a bit, but what little I have learned, I love to pass on. So when I was asked to talk about our three legacies, I thought, what a great opportunity to pass on what little I might know. So, and there's probably folks here who know much more than I do, and so you can correct me afterwards if I've made any mistakes on my understanding of the history. Really, the story of our three legacies is just that. It's a story of our history, because AA is very organic, and AA sort of grew over time. And when I think about a legacy, I look in the dictionary and say, well, what is a legacy? What is the definition of legacy in the dictionary? And it says, and there's a number of definitions, and depending on what dictionary you use, one definition is a gift by will, especially of money or personal property. Well, in this case, we're really not talking about that as much. But the second definition that's most common is something transmitted or received from an ancestor or predecessor from the past, meaning like the legacy of our ancient philosophers or something like that. So it's a gift that has been passed on to us. And what the three legacies are is equated in our recovery, our unity, and our service. And I'll talk about each one of those and where those are demonstrated or where they're... I'm not good with words this morning. I think jet lag hit again. Our three legacies are associated, linked directly to... our recovery is with our 12 steps, our unity is in our 12 traditions, and our service, legacy of service, is in our 12 concepts. When Bill would set up the 12 steps, they didn't come immediately. It's, you know, he didn't have an AA to come to when he got sober. Back in the 1930s, there was a gentleman named Buckman who formed a group called the Oxford Group, and they were not a group necessarily to help alcoholics, per se. They were a group of people who were trying to practice first century Christianity principles. But those principles seemed to work well for people who were trying to get sober. And when Roland H. went to Zurich, Switzerland, and studied under Dr. Carl Jung, and went back to America after that 1 year and got drunk, went back to Switzerland, and Dr. Jung said, there's nothing you can do except for maybe go align yourself with some religious group, and maybe you'll have one of those spiritual experiences that I've heard about and that I've been trying to produce in you, but I've been unsuccessful. So he went back to America and found the Oxford Group. And while he was in the Oxford Group, it's a much longer story than we have time for today, but while he was in the Oxford Group, he and some other guys showed up in court and found Ebby. And Ebby was about to be locked up, and Ebby was Bill's sponsor. And Ebby was going to be locked up, but these drunks showed up and said, turn him over to us. Now, why would the judge be willing to turn over an alcoholic to these people? Well, Sebra Graves was one of the guys that was there in court with Roland H., and Sebra's father was on the bench. He was the judge that day, and that's the only reason why he turned him over. So when Ebby got sober for 2 months, he went and paid a visit on Bill, and he carried a message to Bill, and at that point, Bill needed to know three things. He had been in Towns Hospital three times. He had learned about the problem. He learned about the problem being powerless over the mental obsession and the physical allergy, but he didn't have any solution for it. So when Ebi showed up on his doorstep in 1934, Ebi brought him that second piece, which was the solution. You know, that vital spiritual experience that can help drunks get sober. And he also brought him the tenets of the Oxford group at the time. And Bill kind of, in the beginning, he ended up getting sober in the fall or in December of 1934, stayed dry for a while, tried helping other alcoholics, wasn't successful with saving them, but it kept him sober. And it wasn't until Mother's Day 1935 when he met Dr. Bob. And Dr. Bob ends up getting sober briefly and went out and drank one more time at a convention in Atlantic City, got drunk and came back, and on the 10th of June, 1935, he got sober. And that's when we account for the foundation or the start of Alcoholics Anonymous. But they didn't have any program. They had the tenets of the Oxford group, and they kind of interpreted it into a variety of different ways. The way Bill kind of described it is, he said, well, you got to admit you're powerless. You got to have to get honest with yourself. You have to get honest with somebody else. Go and make amends for things that you've done and help others without any expectation of any reward or demand, and pray to whatever God you might believe in to the best of your ability. It was sort of a six-step program. And that was about the best that they had. But because they had no literature, there was no AA that had been formed yet, for the first couple of years, it was this word-of-mouth program that was getting dissolved and changed and modified based on each person's experience. And Bill saw this coming. And so in 1938, about 40 of them got together, and several of them got together in the New York groups, and they said, you know, how many of us are staying sober on this little six-step deal that we have going? And they counted noses, and there was about 40 people that were staying sober. And they said, well, we have to do something because this message is changing. So they decided, they made three decisions, only one of which came to fruition, which was that they were going to write a book. And they were going to write down this information so that it wouldn't get changed when it going from one person to the next. Because the telephone game. Probably have a similar word for it in Danish. You know, I tell you something, and she tells him something, and he tells her something. And by the time it comes back to me, it resembles nothing like what it was originally said, you know. And that was what was happening to us. So in 1938, they were running around, and they started writing a few chapters of the book. And we're trying to peddle it to publishers to see who would get it. And nobody was interested in us. Nobody wanted to give us any money. And I have a recording of Bill talking about the writing of the big book. It's fascinating. It tells that whole story. And they were very frustrated. And every time Bill would write one of these chapters in the book, he would pass it around to the groups in Akron and the groups in New York, and they would start fighting. And it's like, no, you take all that God shit out of there. No, you got to put more God stuff into it. And, you know, you got to do this. And it was, all the fighting would happen. And this is like people with like 2 weeks sober having their opinion on this as well. And Bill was tired. Bill was tired. He was resentful. And in the fall of 1934, he sat up in bed once with, as he describes, one of his imaginary ulcers. And wondering what in the world could I do? You know, he had written his story. Dr. Silkworth had provided us some great information that went into the doctor's opinion. If you haven't read it, I hope you do. He'd written a chapter on alcoholism to talk about what the disease of alcoholism is and the need for a higher power. That there's two powers. There's power of the fellowship, and then there's a power greater than human power, and why we need a power greater than human power. And then he wrote chapter 3 on more about alcoholism, and what he described in there was four examples of what will happen to us if we don't get that power greater than ourselves, that insanity that will kick in just before we take that first drink. You know, you remember the stories, you know, oh, I decided to go to dinner, and all of a sudden the thought occurred to me, maybe I'll have a highball before dinner, you know. Where does that insanity come from? He was stone cold sober when he made that decision. Maybe I'll put an ounce of whiskey into the milk. It won't hurt me this time, you know. Stone cold sober. So he had to write a chapter to describe that. This is why you need that higher power. But now, for anybody who came in who is atheist or agnostic, like I came in agnostic, it's like we've basically given them an impossible solution. We've told them that you're doomed, You know, you've got this illness or a malady. We don't call it, AA doesn't call it a disease. The medical people do, but we don't. We call it an illness or a malady, at least in our literature. And we told them that you have to find a power greater than you. And to them, it's sort of like we've given them an impossible scenario. So Bill wrote the chapter, We Agnostics, to say, you know what, that hoop that you have to jump through is much bigger than you think. And the notion of believing in something greater than you is as old as humans are, and that it doesn't have to be a deity, a kind of a higher power. And but then he was sort of like, he was sitting up in bed that evening with his imaginary ulcer thinking, I've got to codify this into some sort of experience that, I didn't even start my clock. Okay, I'll figure out where I am. He didn't even, he was thinking, he goes, I got to tell them what the big picture is. I got to tell them what we're trying to do. And he started writing How It Works. And he wrote, he said he got out his pad that was next to his bed and his pencil. And it was as though the pencil had just taken on a life of its own, and it just started writing across the page. I'm getting goosebumps just thinking about that night. And after he wrote out the program of action, he numbered them, and it came out to 12. And he thought, well, 12 is a very spiritual number. There's a number of examples of 12 in spirituality, so you know, maybe this is the right thing. There was a couple of loopholes that he also needed to kind of close up that they had with their six-step program. But can you imagine when he sent that chapter off to the groups in New York and Akron, all of a sudden they're like, wait a second, yesterday we had six, now we have 12. What the hell? I would have been resentful if somebody, my GSR came back to my home group next week and said, now we've got 27 steps, you know, yeah. What the hell, you know? So you can imagine the fights that went on then. And they would say, no, you can't have 12. He goes, yeah, but I prayed before this, and these are not my words, these are God's words. And the fight was on. The fight was on. Until finally he said, you know what, I'm tired of fighting with you. I'm tired of fighting with you. He said, you know, they were like, don't, you can't put all these musts in there. You can't put all these, you have to do this, or you're going to die if you don't. And so you got to soften it up, tell them what you did. You know, our experience shows this is what we did. And he said, but I'm tired of fighting with you. So he said, I'm going to give you a choice. Either you let me finish writing the book and have editorial rights, or else you all write it yourself and I'm just going to drop off. Well, they didn't want to write the book themselves. So they gave in. And you'll notice 2 pages later in your big book, he puts the must and have to and you're going to die right back in the book, you know. And so it loses all continuity in there. I didn't notice it until somebody pointed out to me. And I thought, oh, wow, okay, there was a lot going on in those business meetings. Can you imagine? I thought my group business meetings were harsh, but the writing of the big book really went through. So we got our 12 steps through that. That was our first legacy. And when they appeared in April 1939, It was the fellowship now had that first legacy of those beautiful 12 steps. The 12 steps are kind of grouped into three parts. The first part the first part is really steps one and two are that prep work. And Bill dedicated 5 whole chapters to just steps one and two. Doctor's opinion through chapter 4. And Mary Lee, I'm sorry if I'm taking any of your stuff later, but okay. You can repeat it because I needed repeating. But anyway, so we have a lot. That's how important steps 1 and 2 are. In fact, in the original manuscript, when he wrote How It Works, you know, God could and would if he were sought, the very next sentence said, if you are not fully convinced on these vital issues, either reread the book to this point again or else throw it away. I was like, He knew that you could not go on and take step 3 like we did this morning if you weren't fully convinced on steps 1 and 2. So it would take a little context out. Now the book just goes straight from the, you know, God couldn't would if he ever saw it, to being convinced we were now at step 3. But I never knew what we were convinced of because they removed that sentence. I had to be convinced that there was a power greater than me, that I was powerless, and that there was a power greater than me that was going to restore me to sane thinking again around alcohol. So steps 4 through 9, you know, we sort of prepare ourselves in steps 1 and 2. Oftentimes we take step 1 before we even come into AA, or else why would we show up here if I didn't think I had a problem, unless somebody was like poking me in the back. But we kind of do step 1 and 2 as our prep work. We make our decision. Our first decision that we make is step 3. So I laugh now when some people, we come in and some of us will say, you know, don't make any major decisions in the first year. And I'm thinking, how can you take step three then? That's kind of a major decision to turn your will and your life over to the care of God as you understand Him. That's a big decision. You got to make a decision in your first year, you know? And then we go through our house cleaning. Because as we were talking a little bit about last night, one of the questions that came up was, you know, what is the notion of turning your will and your life over? Well, it's really basically I'm saying is I'm putting myself in God's hand, the God that I came to believe in step two, because I need to be there in a safe place while I'm going to do my house cleaning on steps 4 through 9. Take my inventory, share it with somebody else, become willing to let go of that. The best time to take step 6 is right after step 5 because I'm raw. I am absolutely raw. When I do my fifth step, I've exposed everything, all my warts, all my defects, all my shortcomings, everything to another human being and to the God of my understanding. And I'm raw. Best time to take step 6 is right after 5. And then best time to take step 7 is right after step 6. You know, our big book only dedicates a couple of steps to it, or a couple of paragraphs to it. It was later expanded in the 12 and 12. And it's interesting now because the longer I'm sober, I see the importance of those two steps. Because those two steps of step 6 and 7 become willing to, once again, have God remove these defects of character, and then having the humility and the modesty to ask my God to remove those is so important in all my affairs. I use that at work, I use that at home, I use that in my job, and I use it in my meetings. I still find it hard to use it on the freeway, but I'm getting better, slowly. Once we go through 4 through 9, there's a couple of places actually in our literature where right after we do step 7, Bill actually uses a phrase in there. He goes, remember, it was agreed in the beginning that we were willing to go to any lengths. Because he knew as soon as I'm done with that 7th step, I'm going to go, oh, thank God that is over. And then I see a lot of people that stop right there. And they forget, oh, I still have to now go out and mend all those relationships in my life. Where I've caused harm, and the three biggest places that I've probably caused harm in our big book, you know, chapters to the wives, the chapter to the employer, and the family afterwards, talk about those three very things, those areas that I usually have the most amends to make, and there's also the whole notion of needing to, in practicing these behaviors in all our affairs, or these principles in all our affairs, the notion of practicing opposite behavior. If I want those character defects to be removed, I need to start practicing the opposite of those. Because God's not going to come in and take something away. You know, as I was taught, you know, God abhors a vacuum. You know, you get a jar and you take all the air out of it. As soon as you open it up, air is going to try to flow right back in again. So if I want God to remove something from me, He has to replace it with something else. But I have to do a lot of that effort as well. So when I walk somebody through our first legacy in our big book, through the steps, we walk it out through the big book and not through the 12 and 12. In my hometown, there are a lot of step study meetings go straight to the 12 and 12. And it's been my experience that the 12 and 12 was written a number of years after the big book came out. I mean, as soon as the big book came out, all the questions started going into the office. And it was like, well, what do you mean by this? And do we have to get on our knees to do our third step? And do we have, you know, you only had 2 paragraphs on step 6 and 7. Explain more. And so Bill, you know, wrote some essays that are in the 12 and 12 about, not in the 12, yeah, he wrote the essays that are in the 12 and 12, certainly, to expand on that. To expand on that experience, we learned a lot more. But I find that if I go straight to the 12 and 12 without having first read the steps out of the big book, I may not understand the context for where some of the points are being made from. So if you're new, I'd really encourage you, you know, work with a sponsor or somebody else who's been around for a bit, to look through the steps out of the big book first, and then you'll see how they get expanded in the 12 and 12 later on. The other thing that I also noticed in our big book is after we talk about that first legacy of recovery, it's really not about the alcohol at all. After about, what, page 45 or so, at least in the English book, the Danish book, page 45 would be on about 65, 66. We hardly mention alcohol at all after that. It's really about my thinking apparatus that's the main problem, right? The problem of the alcoholic centers in the mind rather than in the body. And we're not talking about alcohol much after that. So we have these 12 steps, that enable me to live happily and usefully whole with everybody around me. And although AA didn't say that AA will solve all my problems or the steps will even solve all my problems, what it does say is that spiritual principles will solve all my problems. And the way for me that I try to practice those spiritual principles to the best of my ability is by looking at the principles that are embodied in those 12 steps. And I can usually apply them to almost any problem in my life today. What step do I need to look at for this one? Usually it's, I need to take a little inventory of Doug. Or I just stepped on somebody's toes and I need to go quickly make amends to them because I've harmed them even though I may not have recognized it immediately. Or maybe it's like, you know what, here's an opportunity that I can be helpful to somebody else. Here's a great opportunity for me to do a 12-step. So that's our first legacy that was given to us was our 12 steps of recovery. And as the groups were formed, you know, our big book came out and groups were starting to form around the country and around the world. First groups in Scandinavia were in Norway. And we discovered that the literature could be translated and it could be carried through the mail, that people could get sober even if they didn't have a group to be able to go to. And talk about a beautiful legacy, you know, right there, is that that's how powerful this is. But also, as soon as groups formed, problems started occurring, you know, and people would write into the office about this problem or that problem. And what's interesting is that even when the big book came out in 1939, they only had 4 years experience hanging out together, right? And, you know, alcoholics in 4 years can usually cause a lot of problems as well. But in the foreword to the first edition of our big book, there was already the essence of a couple of our traditions. If you look at it, it says at the bottom of the foreword to the third edition in the book, it says, you know, we're not an organization in the conventional sense of the word. There are no fees or dues whatever. Their only requirement for membership is an honest desire to stop drinking. We are not allied with any particular faith, sect, or denomination, nor do we oppose anyone. We simply wish to be helpful to those who are afflicted. So you already see that they were thinking about some of these questions that were coming into their little foundation office that they had formed that grew to then become our 12 traditions. And Bill saw these problems. In 1945, he was starting to think about what kind of principles are the groups going to be able to use to be able to hang together. And so that starts leading into talk on our second legacy, which is our unity and how important unity is. In the first tradition, he talks about our unity is the most important asset that we have because without that, we don't have AA. Because we have unity, I can walk into a room of Alcoholics Anonymous anywhere in the world, in Denmark or in Greenland or in Norway or in Australia or Japan, and I'm going to have the same message. I'm going to hear the same. I may not understand the language, but I'll understand the feelings and I'll understand that language of the heart. But they had to hammer out, there was a lot of things that they were trying to do in the beginning, and groups were setting up membership rules, and they were trying, you know, should we take money from the outside, should we not take money from the outside, who can be a member? And so Bill was thinking, I've got to write some of this stuff down and have it be something that we can pass on, because Dr. Bob was already starting to get sick. Dr. Bob died in 1950, as you know. And so, you know, we're not going to be here forever. They're not going to be able to rely on the wisdom of the founders up on these pillars forever, right? We're going to have to do something that the fellowship can kind of self-manage itself. So on page, in the 12 and 12, I don't know what the Danish page is, but on the English page it's 130. In the 12 and 12, it says that the moment this 12-step work formed a group, another discovery was that that most individuals cannot recover unless there is a group. And he goes on and it says that, you know, the group must survive or the individual will not. And that these experiences that ended up becoming our 12 and the information in the 12 and 12 in the form of our 12 points to assure our future, which is what the original name was, were hammered out on these anvils of experience. And I thank God my first sponsor, I mentioned it last night as well, taught me about our traditions before he started even talking to me about steps. But one thing that he always asked me to do is he said, whenever we look at those 12 traditions, I need to ask myself, what was going on in our history back in the day that caused them to set this down as a tradition that they can pass on to us? And so we have a pamphlet called AA Tradition, How It Developed. And he encouraged me to read through that pamphlet and study that pamphlet in addition to studying the 12 traditions that are in the that are in our 12 and 12. And so in 1945, he started writing a series of essays on that, and it was called The Alcoholics Anonymous Tradition, 12 Points to Assure Our Future. And he really emphasized in that that AA, what really wasn't invented by anyone. What it was trial and error. What works, let's keep doing it. What doesn't work, we need to stop. And they would do everything from trying to, you know, feed these new drunks pineapple juice with sauerkraut. And you know, people would die. Sometimes they're like, you know, somebody died in Bill's home once, and he goes, well, I guess we better not try that one again, you know. So they didn't have any of these traditions, you know. You know, we could do hour-long talks on each one of these traditions individually, and I apologize that we won't have time for that because there is so much rich history in the stories behind these traditions. They're so beautiful. I'm walking a guy out in my home group right now. He asked me to help walk him through the traditions, and we spend an hour and a half every week down at the Starbucks near our home group, once a week going through a single tradition because there's so many stories in there. The whole story is about, you know, the Rockefellers are really who we can be thank for our seventh tradition, and that we don't take money from outside. And a lot of you know that story as well. You know, he gave us $5,000 and said, don't come back and ask me for any more money. And if you go to the archives at our General Service Office in New York, there you can see the check, the last check that we paid to the Rockefellers to pay back that $5,000. So we owe no money to anybody. But those the original essays that he appeared started appearing in the AA Grapevine, which was started getting published in 1946. And I've actually got a copy of all those essays here from 1947 through 1949. If you subscribe to the AA Grapevine, which I think you can do from Denmark, you can have access to the digital archives and go back and look at all the articles that have ever been published, including all of Bill's writings on those original essays. And what I love in there is when one of the points that I particularly love is that in the use of the term humility wasn't as prevalent. He used another word. He used the term modesty, that we should practice a modesty. And for some reason, I like that word, because humility, I think I have to be humble, which is sort of like, you know, self-serving and be a doormat. And that's not what he means at all by being humble. What he's saying is, let's be modest. We don't have to be everything to everyone. I don't have to be out there and say, hi, I'm Doug G., put my face on the front of the grapevine, you know. I can protect my anonymity at the public level because I'm just a drunk. I'm not anybody special. There's a lot of a beauty in that word modesty, and it was, you'll read it in his original essays, but it's not in our 12 and 12, and sometimes I wish that it was back in there, right? So he started writing those essays, and then he took it to the Cleveland Convention in 1950, the first international convention. It was really our first conference, a gathering of delegates from around the country, and to pass on AA to us, to our safekeeping. Because, again, they knew that the founders were not going to be there forever. So now we own the traditions. It is ours, the fellowships. It's not the General Service Office in Copenhagen or in New York that enforces any traditions. Traditions are never enforced. They're voluntarily adhered to. And the reason why we voluntarily adhere to them, just like we voluntarily adhere to our 12 steps, is because we know the pain and suffering that will happen if we don't. So we don't need AA police to go out there and say, your group is not adhering to the traditions, therefore you're not AA or anything. No, if they don't adhere to the traditions, our experience shows that the group will probably dissolve on their own, because this experience has been so strong for us and has lasted since, again, 1950 so well, that all we need to do is go back and try to figure out what we're doing wrong and reflect on those traditions. And one of the ways that we can do that is groups can take group inventories. We can use the traditions checklist that was published in the Grapevine a number of years ago. I was in a meeting in Japan for their 40th anniversary convention 2 years ago, and there was a group from Mongolia there. And the Mongolians are just getting a lot of the translations of our AA literature, and they have the big book, and they have the 12 and 12, and they have probably about 5 or 6 pamphlets in Mongolian, and that's it. And they, one of the staff from the General Service Office was there, and they asked for a meeting, and there was 12 Mongolians and this one poor New York GSO staff member. And they were like, well, we need the translation for the 12 concepts. And he's like, okay, why? Well, you know, groups are like stealing the money, and they're taking this, and they're having membership rules. And he's like, wait, that's not concepts problems. That's traditions problems. And we might be good to go back and study our traditions a little bit more, because there's a lot of rich history in that. And you have the translation in Mongolian. So maybe we can help you to study the traditions again. And indeed, that's what they went back and did. And a lot of those problems were resolved just because they went back and studied our traditions. The traditions are kind of grouped into 3 areas as well, just like our steps are. Traditions 1, 2, and 3 are kind of how the group or how the individual relates to the group. You know, what's... You know, where am I in the group? I'm second. The group comes first. I'm second. You know, where am I in relation to the group conscience? You know, the group conscience comes from a loving higher power, as expressed through that group conscience in tradition 2. And what's my requirement for membership in the group? You know, my requirement is an honest desire to stop drinking. It's interesting that one tradition, we take that one out of context so many times. And we fail to sometimes remember to look at the long form of the tradition. Long form of the tradition says that I need to have a problem with alcohol. And it also says that my membership should never depend upon money or conformity. So basically it's saying you don't have to behave yourself. I don't like to say it that way, but that kind of is what it means. You know, you can come in here and say, I can't stand you people. Your coffee makes me want to vomit. You can take these steps and put them somewhere. And to hell with all of you, but I'm going to be a member of Alcoholics Anonymous. And what do we say? Keep coming back, you know. Because you don't have to conform. We don't have to put money in the basket. It helps to us to do our work, but you don't have to conform. But we find that by me adhering to our traditions, I am able to live a much happier life as well. So if I take the traditions out of context, I might win the battle, but I'm not going to win the war. An old-timer taught me that one, and I'll always remember that. I need to look at the whole tradition. I need to look at the long form of the tradition. In fact, the long form of the tradition is what came out first. And then the short form came out afterwards, probably just because they needed something shorter that will fit on a banner, just like the steps. But the long form came out, and that's really where it embodies the spirit, the spirituality of the experience of those first members that came together. So again, I encourage you as you go through and you look at our traditions, always ask yourself, what was going on in AA history that might have caused this to become a tradition? You know, why do we have our trusted servants rotate on a regular basis instead of just staying in the job forever? Why don't we accept money from outside? You know, because there's strings attached to it usually. Why do we even ask our members to limit how much they can contribute to Alcoholics Anonymous on an annual basis? I don't know what it is in Denmark, but a member can only contribute $3,000 a year in the United States and Canada. Different countries set their own standards for that. Because we don't want a few members supporting AA. We want all of us supporting AA. And even if we only, you know, put 100 krona in the basket once a year, and that goes off to your general service office, it helps them to do their work. And if we all did that, we could probably give away our literature because all of our services that we've asked the offices to provide would be covered, you know. But we forget that, and we figure, oh, well, you know, so-and-so just got a bonus. I just saw them put, you know, 2,000 krona in the basket, so, you know, I don't have to put any money in. No, I get to participate in my recovery by putting money in the basket. So again, I also encourage you to look at the traditions checklist. I think I have a copy of it somewhere, but it is available online as well. And other sources for learning about our 12 traditions I like to use are not just that digital archives, but the 12 and 12. AA Comes of Age. How many of you have read AA Comes of Age before? Yeah, beautiful book. Okay, about 3-4 hands, 6. Beautiful book of our history about, especially, you know, up until 1955. You know, when our traditions were given to us in 1950, Bill was also looking and saying, you know what, we can't rely on this little foundation office. We really need to have all of the voice of AA come together. And so he'd been thinking about having a national conference that would come together once a year with representatives from all over the fellowship throughout the United States and Canada. And he proposed that idea in 1950, and then in 1951, the very first General Service Conference happened in New York. When I was serving as the area delegate in 2003, we were sitting in New York at the conference, and the Archives Committee had brought out, do any of you remember recording on a wire? They used to do audio recordings on a wire instead of on tape or something like that. But they had found this wire recording of an alcoholic from Ohio that was going to be traveling to New York. And he recorded a message from Dr. Bob and Ann to Bill and Lois. It was in 1949, a year before Dr. Bob died. And he was talking, the love you could hear between them was so beautiful. The message to Bill and Lois from Bob and Ann was that, you know, we're really sorry we can't come to New York this fall. And we wanted to talk more about that conference thing that you'd been, you know, proposing. But, you know, Bob's health hasn't been the greatest, and I don't think we'll make it this year. But we love you and wish you all the best. And then we got to hear the reply back from Bill and Lois, back to Dr. Bob. You know, and these men, I don't put them on a pedestal, and they're certainly not saints. But if it wasn't for those two guys and their love for alcoholics and the love and the passion for carrying this message on to us, we wouldn't be sitting here today. And he talked, that message back to Dr. Bob was just beautiful. And here we are in New York at this conference that they were talking about just proposing. And we've got tears streaming down our face. You know, we're all a little bit sentimental. But in that, you know, he started the conference in 1950. And in that, let me refer to one more document that I have here. In 1950s, Bill was starting to realize that his participation in service was going to be drawing to a close. As he said, this sand in the hourglass was running out. And he felt that there was a need to put some sort of a service structure in place that was going to stand the test of time. And on an experimental basis, they convened in Cleveland in 1950, and it was accepted. That structure was accepted on a temporary basis for 5 years. It was accepted in 1955 at the convention in St. Louis. And you can read about that in AA Comes of Age and the speeches that were given there at that convention. And so that was when really the fellowship was once again turned over to our care. It's our responsibility for the running of AA. And it was no longer the trustees on the General Service Board. It was up to the fellowship. And as you go through our 12 concepts, and we don't have a banner for those up here, but in 1960, this would be at the 10th General Service Conference, Bill told the delegates that he was working on a series of essays, of concepts, that would attempt to codify the principles, principal needs and the relationship in our structure. And so he'd been writing those essays, and then in 1962, the 12 concepts were actually published. In the U.S. and Canada, this is our service manual. It's probably the best hidden piece of AA literature that we have. And I say it's hidden because you never see it in any of the groups. Usually only if the group has a general service rep or a group rep will they get one of these. But there is so much beautiful experience in here, and the back half of this book is actually our 12 concepts. And so I wrote a note to myself to read the introduction to the 12 concepts by Bill in the back of the manual here. Where is it? No, it's not the bylaws. Those are interesting if you really want to get into AA. He said the 12 concepts for... No, that's not his introduction. Here's his introduction. 12 concepts for world service described in this manual are an interpretation of AA's world service structure. They reveal the evolution by which it arrived in its present form, and they detail the experience and reasoning on which our operation stands. These concepts, therefore, aim to record the why of our service structure, not the how, but the why, in such a fashion that the highly valuable experience of the past, the lessons that we've drawn from that experience, can never be forgotten or lost. And because, you know, as each generation of service workers comes in, we want to come in and change everything, right? I don't know about here, but certainly that happens at home. And so we, again, like we needed our 12 traditions, we needed our 12 concepts to be able to help guide us. That's how much time I have left? Okay. So there's not 36, I'll break bad news to you. There's not 36 principles in our 12 traditions, our steps, traditions, and concepts. Because there's really not 12 principles in our concepts. They're really broken down into groupings, our concepts are. And the first five concepts talk about the ultimate responsibility, that balance of delegated authority, that the groups are in charge, but we have to delegate that over to the General Service Conference, and then as such, that all service levels, all service workers have a right of decision to make decisions on behalf of the fellowship, even if it's contrary to what their group's conscience is, or they have the right of participation, right of appeal. I mean, how many of us have used the minority opinion? That comes out of our 12 concepts. And then concepts 6 and through 9 describe in more detail about how our structure works, the relationship between the board and the conference and the operating boards of our AA Grapevine and AA World Service Office. I will tell you that the one document that we are, when we look at the 12 concepts, the concept 12 also contains our 6 warranties, and again, due to lack of time, I don't have time to go through them now. But they have really great things in there about how, you know, we don't have unqualified authority over one another, that we don't take any action which is personally punitive towards one another. That's in warranty 5. We don't take actions that are punitive towards one another. And that we act for AA as a whole in whatever we do. We don't act for our own personal gain or personal beliefs. In our literature, when we translate our literature into other languages, we always try to keep the spirit the same as what it was in Bill's writings. But the one piece of literature that we do allow for modifications on is in our 12 concepts, because you don't have, you know, separate corporate boards in Denmark like we have in U.S. and Canada. So the 12 concepts don't really match entirely to what your structure is here. So when we authorize a translation of the 12 concepts, you'll see them probably translated as they are, but we do allow for some modification of that as well. I'm out of time. The 12 concepts, I even have a great document that is 8 pages long. I could have read to you about the 12 concepts, but in the interest of not boring you, and I know coffee is hot in the back of the room, so I'll leave it at that. But that's kind of a short story of what our three legacies are. We were given our steps first, by which we recovered. Before we would start dissolving and breaking apart, we got our 12 traditions, which is what holds us together in unity. And then for us to be able to serve in a structure that is able to function both inside AA and with the outside world, we have those 12 concepts. And so all the information is available. It's just up for us to be able to go reach out and read it and understand it and study it and learn from it, because AA is ours. And if AA is going to fail, it's going to fail from inside, not from the outside, as we've often been told. So thank you for, I hope this wasn't too dry, but thank you for allowing me to pass this on. Okay.
You need help?
Night. I'm good.
Night.
I'm good. Yeah. Okay.